That's the number one thing you have to seek out, because like if you're trying to sell an idea to a company, you have to believe in it, and you can't believe in it until you defend it. And the only way to defend it is for people to take it down.
Welcome to the Entrepreneur Experiment podcast with me, Gary Fox. Each week, the Entrepreneur Experiment discovers world-class systems that founders use to build their business, their body, and their brain. Today, we're talking to Anne Hunt. Anne is the founder of Chasing Returns. Fun fact about Anne, she worked with many of the people who inspired the characters behind the TV show Billions. Her company, Chasing Returns, built software for traders to trade better and more profitably. It's a fascinating story. We go deep on psychology. I recorded this a couple of weeks ago at the Adminovate conference run by my friend at Fundrex. So the sound is a little bit funny. That is why. But overall, it's an absolutely fantastic listen. Here's my chat with Anne Hunt, the founder of Chasing Returns. Thanks to my partner, Square. Everything your business needs, like payments, menu management, online ordering, chatting endlessly about the weather? Well, you're on your own there. Square. Everything your business needs. Almost. Visit square.com. If you're a regular listener of the pod, which I hope you are, you'll know I've been hosting the podcast from my Iconic offices for quite a while now, and things have gone really, really well. So well, in fact, that I'm now a member of Iconic offices, working and recording from one of their spaces. This means I can vouch for the benefits it gives to any business. On that note, Iconic offices have given me a number of exclusive complimentary day office trials for my audience. So try it out for yourself for the day. Bring your team. No catches. Simply go to the web link in the description and enter Gary23, so it's Gary23, to claim your complimentary office for a whole day. It's a pretty fantastic offer. Thank you, Iconic offices. One of the most frequent questions I get asked on this podcast is, where do I find a mentor? And I've never fully had the answer, but now I do. Introducing Mentors Work, a fully funded mentoring program designed to help your business thrive, brought to you by the Small Firms Association in partnership with Skillnet Ireland. Imagine having a series of one-to-one individual mentoring sessions, along with upskilling workshops to network with your peers and learn from experts, as well as a bespoke business plan. And the best part, it's at no cost to you. Join over 2,000 Irish SMEs and see how the award-winning Mentors Work program can help your business to thrive. Places are limited though, so apply today at mentorswork.ie. Program is fully funded until the end of 2023, so get your application in now.
Anne.
Gary.
I was going to say welcome to the pod. It's kind of a pod, kind of a conference. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
Good to meet you.
Yeah, you too.
Give that horrible question of, give a little intro to yourself.
Okay. So I am founder of Chasing Returns, which I set up about 10 years ago, 2014, targeting the retail trading market. So Chasing Returns basically looked at the psychology of trading and provided a risk management platform based around trading psychology. I sold it to what at the time was the City Index brand in the UK, if you know it, or the Forex.com brand in the US. But actually, they in turn got bought by a large Fortune 100 company called StoneX. So I sold it 20 months ago. And 2 months ago, I said goodbye. And I am currently on what I'm calling my sabbatical, which is I have no idea what I'm going to do next. But I have some time to think about
it. What did it feel like the day you walked away?
Disappointing, actually, because I mean, it was financially really successful for us, and we all did really well out of it. And you know, for all the good reasons that you do a startup, it was very successful. But actually, I wanted to be bought by one of our clients because I had built the software to a point and I couldn't really move the needle with trading psychology by not having a direct relationship with the traders, if you can imagine. So it was a B2B2C. So I had, I think, maybe 20% of what I wanted to do done in Chasing Returns. And I really thought I could do the other 80% on the inside. But actually, I failed to make that happen. I failed to infiltrate the organization, persuade them to be innovative, take risks, all the things I wanted to do. So a little bit of me was actually quite disappointed. But I absolutely knew I'd given it 18 months and, you know, I could be there for 20 years to do what I could do on the outside, maybe faster or different or whatever.
So that self-awareness piece, though, I think that's incredibly rare to be able to acknowledge you wouldn't be able to do it. I think a lot of people would have held on and held on and held on. At what point did you realize, no, this is not going to work?
So I'd been harping away at my little vision for the company. And I suppose because I was brought in from the inside, I was like right at the bottom of the pile when I got in. So it was like pitch to this one, pitch to this one, pitch to this one. And I was kind of working through the organization. And eventually I got attention, and the CEO of what was Gain Capital was really keen on what I wanted to do. And he actually flew to Dublin with the CEO of StoneX to come and meet me in Dogpatch Labs, which is where our office was. So I was like, this is it. They're going to actually, you know, give me a remit to go and do this. So they flew in on the private jet and we had a breakfast and we did a whole thing and it was good fun. And I said, just let me bring all the influencers to Dublin. Let me do a 3 or 4 day, you know, strategy session with them. And at the end of it, if I end up presenting back to you, it failed. If they present back to you, it worked. And that was, it was like a black and white thing. If I'm still selling the vision, then they don't have it. It has to be a kind of a corporate vision. So that's literally what, so they said, fine. So we got all the top guys come to Dublin. Of course, everyone loves coming to Dublin. We had a great few days. And by day three, which was we're pitching in the afternoon, they were like, oh, maybe you could do it. And, you know, it was all this kind of whatever. And I just sat down in the back of the room and I was like, I'm going to see who's going to fight for where we want to go. Mm. And they all thought it was a great idea, but nobody wanted to put their hand behind it. So I was like, you know what? That's my sign. I've done my best and I'm done. So
very strategy to flip it around. Bring me back to the very start, though. Where did this idea come from?
Oh, the very start is also doesn't, I don't come across in the best light of the story. But anyway, I suppose I was always interested in trading, right? And I have a computer science background, so I'm a techie at heart. But I ended up working for JP Morgan. And luckily, just, you know, one of those right place at the right time, I ended up in New York for a few months, which ended up to be 10 years. And I ended up working on the trading floor for most of that. So I was around traders all of the 90s in New York, with no interest in trading. Now, when I say traders, you know, it was JP Morgan's trading floor. It wasn't you and me with 10 grand in our trading account. It was a whole other world. So I never.
What were they trading?
Oh, everything. So the FX desk started over there and it went all the way across to the exotic derivatives over here. And credit default swaps were just getting invented. And it was that whole world of derivatives kind of coming online. So everything, every kind of thing. There was one, what they called prop desk, which is trading on behalf of the bank, but everybody else was basically servicing clients for whatever industry they wanted to be in.
Must have been a wild environment.
Yeah, it was absolutely bonkers.
Did you enjoy it?
Oh yeah, every second of it. Loved it.
So how long did you do that for?
I was in New York for about 9 years. And then I decided I had enough of living in New York. I think I'd cycled through. I was probably on my third set of friends. People don't live in New York. Like some of the guys here will probably know Alan's just about to move back from New York. It's a brilliant place to live when you're single and young and your liver's still functioning quite actively because like nothing ever closes, right? But actually, I decided I wanted to come back to Ireland. So I left and became the oldest backpacker in town. Myself and my now husband went off for a year and ended up back in Ireland.
So you took your first sabbatical?
Took my first sabbatical, yeah. Well, maybe not my first, but a sabbatical. Yeah.
Where'd you go?
That time we went to South America for, it was supposed to be for a couple of months, but we ended up staying for 6 months. So we did the old go to Ecuador, teach yourself some Spanish, and then work your way down kind of thing. So we did that, and then we went to Australia, Vietnam, Thailand, maybe, you know.
So and what was your plan? Because leaving New York is a big step. Was your plan to come back to Dublin and work in the same industry, or what was your vision, or
no,
did you have one?
I didn't have a good plan because I didn't feel there was an equivalent career in Dublin based, you know, because I was at JP Morgan, which was a really, it still is considered a really good place to work. But I was very aware that, you know, New York was the center, London was next, Tokyo was, you know, so it was like a global company, obviously. And the, and if you're not in the seat of power, you know, it's not a nice place to be. So, and I remember we'd hand over to London when I was in New York, and then London would hand over to Asia, and Asia had to do all the hours until everything was finished, right? So it's that kind of, I didn't want to come back here and work in a non-headquartered business. So I came back with no idea what I'd do. And I ended up getting a contract with an amazing woman called Alvina Graham at Ulster Bank to do their euro conversion. So it was 1999, I guess, when the banks had to cut over. So I did it 6 months or 3 months, so I can't remember how long it was in there, just on contract, which is great fun. And did all the handover for that. And then I took a job in an e-commerce startup, which I knew nothing about, called Ebion. If anyone's old enough to remember it, it was the first company to massively crash in the 2001 crash, right? But before that, there was a few crazy years of building a services business in that boom time, hiring, giving them pay rises every month, trying to keep them, you know, and we were basically building websites for all kinds of industries. And about 3 or 4 months into that, I realized, God, I thought I knew everything coming out. Oh, I worked in New York, you know, da da da. Going into a real company with the sales targets and operations and actually seeing the bottom line and all of that, I loved every second of it. I just loved it. So that's where I kind of got the entrepreneurial flair of these guys just set up this business. And like, honestly, we'd go out to clients and we wouldn't have a clue how to price the deal. So we'd go, you know, $100,000 and then it would cost us $150,000, but it was okay because we'd sell the next one for $250,000. And it was literally pyramid crazy stuff. But I just loved it. I loved the buzz of it. And then that went bankrupt.
Weirdly enough.
The investors pulled out, weirdly enough. And I was literally due, I just had my first kid and I was due to go back to work. And I hadn't been in Ireland long and didn't have a network and had one job and now it was gone. I was like, what am I going to do now? And I've hired a nanny and whatever. So I again, you know, just as luck would have it, there's some amazing people working in that company. And they went off to other places and hired me in as consultant to do a bit of this and a bit of that. And I ended up actually keeping my own consultancy firm until 10 years ago. So that's what I did for while my kids were growing up. Because it was like paid by the day, you know, make your own hours, add your own value kind of thing. Mm. So through that, I ended up working in a bunch of startups. So I worked with Brightbill, which sold to Amdocs. Yeah. I worked with Clavis Insights, sold to, can't remember. Anyway, so I ended up really luckily working for startups that were really successful. So I got to learn from people like Alan Coleman.
Yeah.
And I was like, just great to see it all on the inside and be on that journey from like the first sale all the way through to.
So you were seeing their whole evolution.
Now I wasn't necessarily there at the beginning and I wasn't there at the end in any of them, but I was there in the middle and I was part of the growth and it was kind of like the operational, how do we pretend we're 1,000 people when we're doing this giant deal and actually there's 4 guys in the corner kind of thing. So that was kind of a skill set because I knew you had to be really professional. It's all about, you know, the front you present and all of that kind of things, but also the quality. You know, some people think working in a startup, you know, the best people have to be in your startup. Otherwise, you can forget it. You absolutely forget it. So about getting the right people and that kind of thing. So I had a lot of experience. Never really thought about doing a startup, to be honest.
Really? In all that
never,
time?
Never. My husband did a couple and I watched him through the ups and downs and the exits and the, you know, he had one success and one failure and they were in that order. So, you know, which is not what you expect. And, you know, he just got hit with a crash and everything. So, but I never really wanted to do it. It wasn't, you know, a dream. I'm going to have my own company.
Yeah.
Until he did it and then a couple of friends. And I was like, I've seen how this works. Maybe I could do something. But I didn't have any idea. Like I literally didn't have any ideas. And so.
So what changed?
What happened was I stopped working and blagged some office space in a place called Wyra, which anyone can remember. It was an accelerator down in
John Rogerson's Quay.
And I was always loved trading and investing. So I started building, you know, ideas around what I might do for my business. And the main idea I had, I might actually do next because I didn't do it at the time. But while I was doing it,
Little teaser there.
My brother is ringing me from California going, I get up at 6 every morning. I trade for 3 hours and I've been making all this money. And then I go to work at 9 because, you know, he's on the right time zone or whatever. And I started trading. Now, I didn't just start. I went out, read all the psychology books, got myself a strategy, did a diploma, got the first class on, you know, did all of the stuff, you know.
Had you been trading back in New York
on the desk? No, no.
Okay.
No, no. I was building risk technology. So I saw the trades, but I wasn't trading. No, not at all. I was supporting traders.
And you never even dabbled back then? You never attempted to?
Never.
Too close to it?
Just... Maybe. We had a thing on the trading floor, which became a story I used to tell when I'd be trying to flog chasing returns, which, as in sell the service
of course.
Which is, you'd look along the trade, and the trading floor would be bigger than this room now. It was a very long room, and you could see whichever desk was excited, you'd see the buzz, right? And if you looked at them closely, and you'd see, you know, they were all guys pretty much, you know, it's 20 guys sitting around the desk, and the phones would be hopping, and, you know, whatever the usual. And you'd know, you'd go, I'm pointing at Ed over there now. That guy is in trouble. He's going to blow up his account, right? And he would. And everyone would know who was about to, you know, lose their shit, but except for the person themselves.
Right.
And it was, so I was always fascinated by the psychology of it, but I never had any interest in doing it. Anyway, until I finally got ready, put $5,000, which is the exact amount. I put $5,000 in a trading account on the 1st of November. It might have been 2014. I can't remember the exact. Must have been. Maybe it was 15. Anyway, around that time. And literally 2 days before the end of the month, it was at 9,998. I literally had doubled my money, give or take. So I worked hard till I got it over the line and then told everyone, oh, I'm trading for a living now. And I doubled
now
my money
a trader.
A month and whatever. And I was like, why wasn't I doing this all my life? Anyway.
But just did every month and double every month.
Yeah, exactly. And cut through. It took maybe 3 months for me to lose it all.
Okay.
As in lose the $5,000 and a bit more. So I was now down and I was like, okay. So I had the self-discipline to go stop and try and figure out what happened. So I went back into, you know, and I knew what happened. And this is what happens to all traders. It's not what you trade. It's not what you buy. It's none of that. It's totally about your psychology. It's about staying in the right ones and cutting the right ones and all of that kind of stuff. So the more interest I got in trading psychology, the more I realized that, you know, every broker is trying to teach you how to trade and they teach you all the numbers over here and they give you a psychology book over here. They don't tie the two together.
Okay.
So I had this idea then about why don't I, you know, use my trading data and measure and see if I can't identify with a bit of smart tech where the psychological moments are and how I might stop them. And so that was the genesis of Chasing Returns.
Did you start reverse engineering your own trades to tie into your psychology and your emotion?
I was first, my brother was second, and then I was like, okay, now I need some traders. And so then I went online and wrote some article and got some guy in a newsletter to put an ad to go, free analytics if you send me your trading history. So I sourced a bunch of literally spreadsheets and built some spreadsheets.
Okay, so that was the first bit, because that's always the bit that trips people up. How do you get your first X number of users? So what did you do?
So what I did is I took, you know, what was fairly rudimentary analysis of like me and Colm, me and my brother, right? And I turned it into beautiful charts, as you can do pretty easily. And I basically compiled a sample report. And it had all of the biases around trading in it, which is exactly what went into the first version of the software. So it would talk about your returns are 5%, right? Or whatever. Your returns when you're trading twice as fast as normal are minus 20%. Or your returns when you're in a losing streak are minus 86% or whatever. So I was able to show that you can take your trading, and most traders are never, you know, 85 to 90% of traders lose in the long term. So they go through windows of winning and losing. But actually, if you pick out the psychological trades, as we started to do, most of the losses are in fact, I can remember the metric. If you eliminate 2% of your trades as a losing trader, you'll be profitable. So these guys have done 10,000 trades. You only need to get rid of a couple of hundred. So anyway, so I was able to show that we can analyze you and tell you what your strengths and weaknesses are. Are you good in a winning streak? Some people are. Some people are really bad. A couple of winners, they give it all back. Other people are like, I'm winning, I'm going to stick with it, and they get in a zone, right? So nobody knows where they are really. So if I said to you as a trader, you're really strong on a winning streak, you'll go, yeah, I know. And I'll go, this is how much it makes for you. This is how you should manage your trading capital in a winning streak and double your overall returns. And so that's where the genesis of the thing came from. So I built it on a spreadsheet, gave away my free reports. I was lucky. One of the guys who sent in his data was actually a hedge fund manager. And then he gave me some testimonials about how useful it was and handed it on and kind of went from there.
Okay. And how did you get your first kind of, they were your first users, but in terms of like scaling it out, getting customers, what was your first route to market?
So my first, so I, then I had the, well, what kind of a business model is it really? Is it B2C? Is it B2B? Right. So I was really keen on the direct to trader piece until I did the numbers. And then I'm like, you can't compete online for traders because A, you're competing against brokers. They're the most expensive, you know, people to acquire online. Yeah. And at the time, which is still actually true, the broker industry is using online paid. You know, it's just you're competing against the very people who actually are not even against you. So it wasn't going to be a successful business model. So I turned it into a B2B. And then the pitch was not your traders will do better because, you know, not the clients who bought us in fairness, but many, many brokers absolutely don't mind that their traders come in, blow up, because they just keep filling the pipe. And that was always the history in that industry. And it's been changing very slowly, but actually going into a broker saying, we'll make them do better was not the message. That's not what they wanted to hear. So the message actually, or what I needed to prove was, if you can keep them doing better, they will stay longer and actually make, you know, deposit more money, because it's deposits that really drive the revenue kind of thing. And that was a hard sell because no one believed me and I couldn't prove it because it was a, you know, it was your obvious experiment. But I eventually persuaded a really good broker to trial it. And it turned out to be true. Thank God. Because I don't know what I would have said if it wasn't. But it turned out to be true. So when we looked at traders, we could see they were still losing, you know, less of them were losing. So we were able to move the needle on the percentage of traders losing. So that's always great. But because they were doing better, we made them trade smaller, which is the biggest thing. You know, traders lose money because they lose track of what percentage of the capital they're losing. So if you put $5,000 in an account, you can't be risking more than a couple of hundred on a trade. And some of them were. So we were able to make them trade a lot smaller, which meant they did a lot more trades, which means they got more of a habit going. And then their losses were smaller, et cetera, et cetera.
What kind of feedback or what kind of interaction were you giving them?
We were not able to give live feedback at this point. So we were literally giving them a platform to come in and analyze based on different behaviors. So we had strategy, we had timing, we had psychology. We ended up in the end with lifestyle as well, because we did a really fascinating experiment. The only cool thing I was able to do in there, which was we linked in Fitbit data. So we were able to correlate your performance with your sleep. And that kind of stuff. So and then we were also able to let them tag their own stuff. So, you know, these are ones I think should have been good and they weren't. And so they could start building their own profiles.
Okay. So they that could feed it in and make it smarter from their own data. Okay. Yeah. And then how were they able to kind of interpret that, I guess, in terms of how smart was it in prompting them to, you know, like the Fitbit or the Whoop or whatever, it kind of goes, oh, you're in the red zone. You didn't sleep well last night.
So at the beginning, it wasn't helpful at all. It was like, great, what do I do now?
Yeah.
You know, well, you're bad at this and you're good at this. So, so where it went to was to say, you know, because you'd never say to a trader, or I never say to a trader, don't do a trade. So let's say, you know, you're really good trade in the S&P, but you're crap at FX or for whatever reason, right? It's a bit of an exaggeration, but if you don't keep trading, you're never going to learn, right? The mistake people make is to keep trading at the same level. So why don't you be smarter about your capital allocation? And, you know, here's a really simple one, right? Which was a great way to sell the product, right? Because a broker would say to me, oh, they'll just quit if they see this. So one of the metrics in there was called first trade of the day. And it was just this bonkers metric that, you know, most traders will do between, I don't know, 5 and 50. You know, everyone's very different, but they do a number of trades every day. So if you isolated the first trade of the day and looked at it, about 40% of traders had a massive, what we called an edge. They were statistically different on the first trade of the day. They may be better or they may be worse. And it was kind of 50-50 on that, but they were different. Okay. And so we'd go through a, well, find, you know, 20 of each and interview them and try and figure it out and come up with a hypothesis to why this was true. And why it was true is because if we look at the people who were, and often professional traders, right, who were successful. And I'll give you one example, right? We had one trader, we got a year's worth of his history, right? And these profits in the year, his P&L was 250 grand, okay? So he made $250,000. Happy days, right? When we isolated the first trade of the day, which was 10% of his trades, right? He lost 350, right? Which means he had to make it all back on the rest, right? So he had this massive problem that he'd get up in the morning and he would be like, yeah, yeah, yeah. He'd be sitting at his desk waiting for 7 o'clock. Couldn't wait for the markets to open. No discipline. He just wanted to be in the markets. And he was at his worst on the first trade of the day.
Wow. So was it his eagerness was causing
it? His total eager. Yeah. Wow. Yeah. So I nicknamed it, and it's a well-known term in trading, fear versus greed. Right. So some people are very fearful. Some people are very greedy. And that was the one number in the platform that would tell you if you were on one side of that or the other and how badly it was for you. Because the disciplines, the fear-based trader will get up in the morning and they might take 2 hours to put on that first trade. Amazing. Right. And if you look at its performance over the course of a year, they're incredibly successful trade. They might be, you know, double the win rate and double the, they might be all those things, but they wouldn't be smart enough to go, well, actually, why don't I double the size of the risk on those trades? Because actually that alone totally moves the needle. So it was linking the behavior to the, and putting the right risk on the right trades.
That's
what software was doing.
That's incredible feedback. We're using Slido as well. So if you have questions for Anne, pop in Slido and I'll do them at the end. But that sort of feedback is literally invaluable. Like, what sort of feedback were you getting from the traders going, was this like an, oh, damn moment? Were they going to go, and this is...
So I used to do a lot of one-to-ones at the beginning, you know, you'd get a good trader on and you'd offer him a free review of the data. And this is really nerdy now. When I'd get a guy, there are mostly guys, when I get a guy's data, I'd know what he was going to be like. I could tell his personality. I'd know if he was shy and retiring, because you'd know from the metrics.
Really?
Yeah, because you'd go, right. Because you might get a guy who's like terrible on the first trade of the day and he might have these massive, you know, hits after a few winners in a row or a few losers in a row, and you'd know, totally emotional, Togo, you know, and he'd have these huge winning trades as well. So you could also look at, you know, maybe 80% of the trades are sitting in the middle doing nothing and the outliers are just kind of bonkers. So you'd get a sense of the personality of the people. So I never met a trader who didn't already know what I told him. So we literally, you go, you know, your first trades of the day really not helping you. And you go, yeah, I kind of know that. And then you go, do you know what's cost you? Like that guy, do you know that cost you 250 grand last year, or the 350 grand last year? And that's when they fell. That was the fall off the chair moment. It was putting a number on the behavior.
Right. So they knew broadly.
Yeah.
But they didn't.
I mean,
know
everyone knows, like, it's a bit like, you know, you go to your nutritionist and said, you know, if you ate that chocolate cake, you know, you wouldn't have whatever. And they go, yeah, yeah, yeah. And then they go, you know, you ate 100 pieces of chocolate cake this year. That accounts for it's that. That's right. All it is. It's, but it becomes less about something soft for them to think about and a hard number. You put a hard number in front of a trader and go, you lost that much. And the thing about the psychological edge is you can do something about it. Now, you can't stop yourself being overeager in the morning without maybe a long time with your shrink, but you can make a rule that says, I'm only going to put 10% of my normal bet size on. So our second product was that. It was like, we're going to give you your own set of rules. You can figure them, and then we'll help police you. And if you break your own rules, because we weren't regulated, so it was like, they're not our rules, they're your rules.
Okay.
So then we had this green, amber, red. This is, you're now in a danger zone. You've broken your rules. You've been ill-disciplined. And when this happened last time, this is your chance of success.
Okay. Talk to me about the rules. If people are traders or they're into trading here in the room, what were the rules that most people used?
So the rules were actually pretty simple. There was three, let's see if I can remember what they were now. Your money, your mind, and your metrics. Those are the three categories, because I was all about the buzzwords, right? So your money was the most important thing. You know, how much are you going to risk? So again, new traders will come in and go, I'll just put 50 quid on every trade. Well, 50 quid on every trade is grand if you deposited, say, 1,000 euro in the account. But if you've depleted that down to 100, you're now betting half your money on something that's not likely to make it. So it's about, linking, you know, linking your risk to how much money you have. So basic dynamic money management, you know, it's 1% or 2%. And then we give you your new balance every day. You know, yesterday you had 10 grand, so you were allowed to risk 100 euro per trade. Today you've got 15 grand because you did really well yesterday. So now you can put 150. So even just managing that. So they come in, get their numbers for the day. And then we'd set them targets for stopping. You know, if you're in a losing streak, how many trades will you let yourself lose before you have to stop for the day? And they'd be able to tell from their history that, you know what, if I have three losers, the fourth one tends to when I, you know, have an issue. So I'm going to stop at three. And then if they didn't, we mark them down. So we gave them a point system.
Okay.
And then the same with, you know, how many would I open at a time? The other thing we used to identify, we called it the board trade. Right. We had this guy and it was like, how come when he has one trade on, he does really well, but when he has a second trade on, he does really badly? Can he not just do two things at once? And it was nothing to do with that. It was, it became a meme. It was like somebody would put on a real trade that he was planning to leave on for a few weeks. And then every day he'd come in to have a look at it. And while he was having a look at it, he'd be like, ah, let me do a bit over here. And they became the board trades where people shouldn't be in the market, shouldn't even be in there. And they're just messing around. And it totally can, you know, their one trade that they really wanted to do can be really successful. But all this noisy stuff that they shouldn't have been allowing themselves to do is where they were losing all their money.
It's phenomenally, these incredibly intelligent people, because obviously they're educated.
But it's the hardest job in the world.
You literally can't help yourself. It's the definition of not being able to help yourself, even at a high level when you know it's hurting you.
Yeah, totally. I mean, studies done in monkeys where they taught them they taught them about risk. Around, you know, swapping coins for bananas. And in some cases it's a fixed, and in other cases there's a variable component to it. And they've absolutely proven that when there's a variable component, when there's a risk, and particularly with, you know, when it comes to money, if you're losing, we become risk seeking. So what happens to our trade is, so we invented a metric which we called disposition effect because we wanted to sound sophisticated. But all it is was, how long do you spend in a winning trade and how long do you spend in a losing trade? Divide one by the other. And we'd have people with a 0.05, right? So what happens is, you buy an Apple share for $100, right? And the price goes up. So you look at it tomorrow and it's 105 and you're like, hey, I've made a fiver and I've bought 1,000 of them, whatever it is. Your instinct is to close that, take your money. Right. If you went in and it said 95, your instinct is, I'll leave that for another while, see what happens. And that's literally, we're more risk seeking when we're down. We just wanted to get back to break even. And so people come in and they literally open trades. They close all the winners at the end of the day. We leave the losing trades there. Come in the next day, they open a bunch more, they leave the losing trades there. I've been in high net worth meetings with really big traders who have losing trades on for a year and they just won't close. Oh no, they'll come back. I'm just ignoring all them. They'll be down like millions sitting there and they'll be here just trading away going, oh, I made some profits today. Yeah. And they're literally in denial about, you know, if I don't close it, it's not really a loss yet.
Okay. Is that it? Is that the bit? If I don't close it, I haven't lost.
Yeah. I haven't realized it.
Okay.
Yet. And so we would never say these are your losses for the year. We'd go, this is your disposition. And this, if you're not at 1-1, you have this problem. So now think about that and just get and think about it in a different way.
What are the traits of a good trader?
Oh, everyone's different. Like the one thing they say, you know, if I have a winning strategy and it's been winning for years and I give it to you, you'll lose money. So it's match your trading style to your personality.
Okay.
Totally.
So you can have a wildly different personality type and be a good trader.
So if you are, you know, if you're one of these, you know, adrenaline seeking junkies, you should be trading Bitcoin. You shouldn't be in some boring stock and doing the right thing because you don't have the patience for it. You should know. So your time frame has to match your personality.
Okay. Know thyself.
Know thyself. Yeah.
How much does the psychology of trading tally over into the psychology of being a founder?
Oh,
there's a lot of similar traits there. There's a lot of things you're telling me that I've heard a lot of times from a lot of different founders.
What professional traders will say is most good traders have their own psychologist. Like they go to therapy and they keep it in their lives. And to be a good trader means you're good at every, like all those disciplines of trading. you know, they're good in every part of their life, whether they're entrepreneurs or career people in large organizations. It's about discipline. It's about knowing yourself. It's about cutting your losses. I guess it's true for entrepreneurs. It's true in all careers. Let's face it. You know, if you're in a job that's just not going anywhere or whatever, I think. So I think massively, because the skills you need to be a good trader make you good at all parts of your life. Really do. And if you meet a really good trader, they're so successful. You know, they're so successful with their families, with their work-life balance. You know, a good trader never says, I've been at my desk for 18 hours. They say, oh, I did my 5 minutes in the morning and my 10 minutes in the afternoon. Like literally they just, it's a life.
Is that an experience thing? Have you seen that at different stages of trading? Or is that, you know, we were just in a conversation previously outside about, you know, the creation of value.
Yeah.
You know, it's not about how hard you worked. It's about how much value did you create in that moment.
So I think if I met 100 people who decided they want to start trading, you'll know from their personalities the ones who have no chance.
Really?
Yeah, because they don't have that that mindset of that they have a, well, I put in my hours, you know, or I did all, you know, instead of, you have to take personal responsibility all of the time, and you've got to be really self-aware, and you've got to work really hard to learn. I mean, they say it takes 10 years to become a good trader. Now, I don't think if I could finish the software, it might be easier. But, and a lot of that is nothing to do with understanding the markets. I mean, you know, there's massive studies in trading. Well, there's a number done, which is, you know, I'm going to give a signal and you're going to buy it and I'm going to sell it, right? And both can make money. So it's nothing about learning the craft. It's about learning the psychology.
In terms of then being a founder, when you started off on your own, solo doors, what was it like? You know, you'd been a consultant, so I'm sure it's not that much of a transition over. But when you made that switch into founder, how did you manage your own psychology?
I think being self-employed for all those years really helped. Mm. And I always did have a mindset of, you know, even though, you know, I was a consultant to startups, they were mine. You know, I was invested in their success. And, you know, that's kind of in my personality anyway. And also, I suppose, you know, I'd been in a leadership roles, you know, I hate buzzwords, for a long time. So I was kind of used to going it alone, and I didn't mind that or find it difficult. I built some good advisors around me, people who would like, were really hard on me. So I didn't pick anyone who were like, oh, you're doing great. You didn't need that. So I always had a lot of, you know, people to pick holes in what I was doing and all that kind of stuff. So
how do you build that? Because I think a lot of people are afraid to get that feedback. You seem quite a direct person. You seem like you're straight to the bone.
No. Yeah.
So you gravitated towards those people. So how do you find them? Because I think a lot of founders, they're afraid to hear honest feedback, especially in the early doors, because they're afraid they'll just be told, look, this is just a bad idea.
But that's the number one thing you have to seek out. Because like, if you're trying to sell an idea to a company, you have to believe in it. And you can't believe in it until you defend it. And the only way to defend it is for people to take it down. So like, somebody said to me, well, like, how do you plan your day? My co-founder, Yulia, who's not here, is a planner. She's like, you know, so unbelievable. She knows exactly what's on which list and what has to be done and all that kind of stuff, which is why she's my favorite person to run a business with, because I'm not like that. But when I come in the morning, she'll say, but you said yesterday you were going to do X. And I'm like, yeah. But actually, you know, every morning I go, what's my biggest worry my long term, where I'm trying to get to? And if there's something at play that I can do, that's what I work on. So I just always thought, you know, the more negative feedback you get, the stronger you'll build your business. It's everyone should be looking for negative feedback. And if you don't have the resilience for it, you can learn it.
How do you give good feedback?
I don't know if I do. You'd have to ask people who would give advice to, I suppose. How do you give? I mean, I'm brutally honest with feedback to people.
Okay.
I think that's fair to say. I just say what I think. And if I think someone isn't taking it well or it's not going to suit them, then I don't give them any more after that.
Okay.
You know, it just doesn't suit.
But you brought on a co-founder. What was the thinking behind that?
Sorry?
You brought on a co-founder.
Yeah.
What was the thinking behind that?
Well, when I hired her, when I hired Julia, she was just finishing her PhD. So we decided to call her a co-founder after a couple of years because she was with me right from the beginning. So she wasn't there for the company setup or any of that kind of stuff. But she is my right hand, left hand, all my hands or whatever. So it made sense and it was good for her and good for both of us to have kind of a team together.
Was she the yin to your yang? Was she
exactly.
Quite different to you?
Totally different. Yeah, totally different.
So as you've left now and you kind of seem like you have that fire in you, would you go again?
Yeah, totally. I've banned myself from thinking about it till September. So I've definitely I'm 3 months into my sabbatical.
Okay.
Because I was like down a tunnel for 7 or 8 years and the world has moved on and the world has changed. And I'm pretty single-minded when I'm doing something. It's like other people's startups, I don't care. You know, I'm trying to catch up with the world without thinking about myself at all or my industry, just learning all this other stuff about what's going on. Which it will inspire me, hopefully.
What area are we going to go back into?
Oh, I'm going to stay in the same area because I love it. But my thing at the minute, this may not have anything to do with anything, but my thing in the minute is, because, you know, what do women do when they finish working for a while? They try to lose weight and get healthy. So I've been doing all of that stuff, right? And because I was doing that whole Fitbit thing, I'm massively currently looking at, fasting and devices, and everyone's got their blood sugar monitors on, all this kind of stuff, right? And, you know, I can absolutely... Now, no, traders should know their blood sugar. And so I think that world of, health has moved on so much. And now technology has caught up, apart from the AI and all of that stuff as well. But like, if we even just look at, genetic testing and, knowing your personality, like ADHD is now a gene. You can tell if you've got it, and either, so... linking your and because trading is the hardest job arguably in the world, or being an entrepreneur, maybe you need to be healthy, you need to be at your game. So if you're like the Whoop device telling you don't make any big decisions today because you work too hard in the gym and you're a bit wrecked and you didn't sleep enough or whatever, I feel like I might go down somewhere tie that together maybe.
Yeah, we had a super nerdy wearable chat last week. Get back in your bloods done as well, just going deep on the health space. That it really is
transforming. I just got my bloods 20-page report. I'm on ChatGPT trying to analyze every line. It's interesting. But yeah, maybe something around that.
Last couple of minutes, and everyone's going to do the questions. So what advice would you give to yourself? So you're about to start again. What advice are you going to give to Anne the second time around?
That is a really good question.
Thanks. I got there in the end, 40 minutes in.
They were all really good questions.
I was fishing for it.
Come up for air more often, I think.
How do you mean?
I think I tend to get hyper focused and I'm off on a whatever. Even looking at a 3 month, sprint thing, I might be putting a new product out or something in the software. At any time I get to the point of, I'm stuck, I'm going to stick my head up for air and I'll go off to London for a few meetings and I'll talk to myself for 3 days or whatever. They're the windows where all my creativity happened.
Okay.
When I stopped. So I didn't do enough stopping and looking around and smelling the roses or whatever. I think I could have moved a lot faster if I did. So next time around, I'm not a young founder. I wasn't a young founder 10 years ago. I'm certainly not going to be this time. So I'm not going to be looking at a 10-year thing. I want something to be up and running and successful a lot faster than that. And for me, I think that's making sure I have my out of the weeds and in the clouds and spending time away and being more creative. Okay. So that's probably what I need to do.
It's good advice. Slow down to speed up.
Slow down to speed up. Thank you. Very good.
Couple of questions. Could the product be used for gambling?
Yeah, it could in theory. And it would certainly have applications for there. And actually, one of the products that I used to like to look at when I was thinking about this was a product called Poker Tilt, which measures tilt in poker players based on metrics and very similar metrics to what I put into the platform as it happened. It could. Now, obviously, it's regulatory and different, and would they care and would they offer it? And, you know, is there a business model for it? I don't know. And it's not one I'm particularly interested in, but it absolutely could and should. There should be versions of this for people, I feel.
What advice would you give someone that wants to start trading in their spare time?
Oh, it's the best crack ever. I highly recommend it. You can open a demo account, so you don't need to use your own money, but you need to treat it like your own money. And there's a wealth of happy days ahead, I just think. But if you like it too much, that's bad. Right? If you like it for the emotional highs and lows, you're doing it wrong.
Okay. Don't get your kicks from it. Just
guess who doesn't trade
enjoy
anymore.
It just enough. Well, but the last question is kind of about that. No. Were you able to turn around your own trading performance using your product, or are you still down $5,000?
I did make it back, but I stopped trading totally to build the business. And then I thought briefly when I stopped about going back into it, but I can't do two things. And I'd say on a, you know, if it takes 10 years to become a good trader, I probably only have 1 year in. So if my software was finished, which it wasn't, maybe I would. But I'd rather go back and build what I want to build.
Okay. So watch the space for September.
Well, or October or November at some point, yeah.
At some stage. And
at some point.
It's been an absolute pleasure. Anne Hunt.
Thank you.
From Chasing Returns.
I hope you enjoyed today's episode. If you did, please hit subscribe on Spotify, Apple, or wherever you get your podcasts, as it really does help the podcast grow and reach new people. If you want to learn more about the podcast, go to mrgaryfox.com. I'll see you back here in a couple of days for a brand new episode.